We did it. I still can't believe we got this project done so fast and so well.
When I'm in New York,
I'm in Chicago,
and I'm in LA. But
we're making it happen in Miro.
Together.
Our best work just happens faster on Miro's collaborative online whiteboard. No more scheduling meeting after meeting for work that could happen
from anywhere, whether it's getting design feedback here,
mapping timelines here,
or brainstorming next steps here. It all just happens on the Miro board.
Exactly. And it's nice not having to wait an entire day to get sign-off from this guy.
Hey! Well, it is true.
See how Miro users save up to 80 hours every year by meeting less and doing more. Get on board at Miro.com. The first three boards are free forever. That's Miro.com.
The Boys in the Band podcast is brought to you in partnership with Giddy Stratospheres, the fantastic independent film by Laura Jean Marsh, set in the heart of the noughties indie scene. It's a story of furiously loyal friendship and a love song to an incredibly special time for music and mayhem, all set to the soundtrack of the best noughties indie tunes.
A must watch for any noughties indie fan. You can buy or rent the film on a host of platforms, including Amazon Prime, Sky Store, and iTunes. But as part of our partnership with Giddy Stratospheres, we're delighted to be able to offer listeners to the Boys in the Band podcast an exclusive 20% discount to rent the film via Vimeo On Demand. Just follow the link in the podcast notes or post it on our social media and enter the promo code Boys in the Band at checkout. And you'll be able to stream the film for as little as £3.59.
A terrific deal that's an absolute must for listeners to this podcast. This fantastic offer is available in the UK and Ireland only at the moment and runs until 10th of September. So go check it out. Giddy Stratospheres, a film about loss and love in the storm of guitars and broken glass that was the noughties UK indie music scene.
Hello and welcome to the Boys in the Band podcast. I'm Richard Gallagher.
And I'm Peter Smith. And on this week's show, we're joined by Ben and Kieran from the Cooper Temple Claws. And it's always good fun, I think, when you get a couple of different band members in a see things from different perspectives and recount stories from different angles. And it's good fun chatting through. And it's good fun chatting with Ben and Kieran about the Cooper Temple Claws story as well. And, well, we've heard some good sort of tour bus stories from various different bands, but these guys came up with a good tour story for us, playing football in a car park with Muse, a bunch of Cure fans, and then taking a game, I think, was it out in Sweden, where they ended up playing against Brazilian acrobats in the car park of the stadium they're going to be playing in later on. Here's the story.
Yeah, it's also where things soured with Muse, wasn't it? Because Fish tackled Chris, and Chris broke his arm, and they had to go home from the tour, and they had to get a replacement musician for when they were headlining the festival. But Fish maintained it was a legitimate tackle, and if it was a fair tackle, then, you know, I guess it's Chris's fault for coming off worse. I think
if you're going to play competitive football on a very hard concrete surface
under the influence, you know,
yeah.
I think so. But yeah, it's funny that those football games started to morph into it, end up being about 20 a side with bands playing. We had sort of, I remember Alpha de Mal was touring, they were all into it. Then we had fans, Cure fans joining in as well. So that was, yeah, that was good.
We also had a pretty intense football match in Howden Festival in Sweden where we were pitched against a team of Brazilian acrobats. And I was... We never were that fit, but we were trying. I just remember being on the wing, and I had to like try and check this guy who was like running a million miles an hour. But I kept up with him.
Yeah, love it. Always take a football with you wherever you go, and you can get enough people together to make a match happen. It was interesting to actually hear Ben Kieran saying that a real gang of mates who formed this band and actually ended up having a real sort of strong bond between them. And I know they enjoyed touring with Biffy and Muse in the early days, but they were just a tight-knit group, I think, who just loved travelling the world together, didn't they, Rich?
Yeah, and they gave us a good insight into some of their writing together and how they came by some of their biggest tunes, like Who Needs Enemies off their debut record, See This Through and Leave, Blind Pilots as well, Kick Up the Fire and Let the Flames Break Loose, and mentioned that video of Michael Fassbender for Blind Pilots as well.
Yeah, crazy video, that. if you remember it, where he ends up going on a night out with his mates, drinking and drinking, and then turns into a goat by the end of it. It's all very odd. Talking of odd, what about the you were telling us about as well, trying to break up long sessions in the recording studio for their second album, I think it was, where they'd have fancy dress Thursdays. So I think it was all just a bit surreal at times in this band, where they're laying down tracks dressed up as various sports people or celebrities.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, the band called it a day after album number three, but Ben and Kieran are actually back working together now on a new project called Type 2 Era, with some brand new music out and available for you to check out as well.
Yep, so give that a listen. But first, check out our podcast, the Boys in the Band podcast, with Ben and Kieran from the Cooper Temple Claws.
This week on the Boys in the Band podcast, we're delighted to be joined by singer and guitarist Ben and keyboard player Kieran from the Cooper Temple Claws. How's it going, guys?
Really good. Thank you.
Yeah, good, yeah. Thanks for joining us.
Speaks to both of us.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good to have you on. And, well, the first question in the sound check, which is our sort of three quick-fire questions at the top of the podcast, is normally, where are you? But Kieran, you appear to have a beautiful beach backdrop on this Zoom call. Is that where you are?
That's right, Peter. Like, the last couple of years have been quite good to me, and I've got a little hideaway in the Bahamas. I'm in East London, but by the miracles of wallpaper, I'm just looking at this white sand turquoise ocean, which probably none of us are going to get this year, but there you go.
Yeah, this is as close as we'll get to a holiday. How about you, Ben? Where are you?
I'm about half a mile from Kieran. The restraining order wouldn't let me any closer. But I'm in sort of a back garden, a little shed. We've both sort of been around Hackney for the last sort of 15 years or so.
Awesome. Second question in the sound check, guys. We always ask our guests what you're listening to at the moment. So Ben, you want to kick this off? Who are you into at the moment?
And does it have to be at the moment, or can I sort of just...
No, go
so bands that are pretty much always on repeat are Depeche Mode and Deftones. And then a recent album that I stumbled across was by a band called White Flowers. I don't know anything about them. They just sort of came up. Started listening to it, sound like Cocteau Twins. So it's really melodic and evocative. And yeah, I really like them. So probably find out more about them. And if we can ever see gigs again, definitely go and check them out.
Cool. How about you, Kieran?
My brother-in-law has recently introduced me to an Australian act called King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. And I'm just loving their craziness. And sort of aspiring to be that psychedelic and unique.
They're incredibly prolific, Kieran. Sorry to interrupt your quickfire answer. They're incredibly prolific. They write loads of amazing albums really, really quickly.
Yeah, you know them.
Well, not personally. I'm just always astounded about, you know, they've always got new records sounding great, sounding different.
I think last year they gave themselves the modest target of five records, five LPs or something in 1 year, whereas we're the exact opposite, which we'll come to in a minute. really enjoying them.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, that's the next question, isn't it? Because you guys have obviously been busy forming Type 2 Era over the last year or so. So tell us about this and Pushing Up. The single's coming out 9th of July. So depending on when you're listening to this podcast, go and check it out. But tell us about this project.
Yeah, so Type 2 Era started quite organically. Kieran and me were both in London, living close to each other. And it was, I guess it started from Friday night jams, didn't it, Kieran? Bottle of Jack Daniels, one of us cooked dinner, and then we'd catch up on the week and then get some instruments out without any intention of taking it anywhere. And bit by bit, slowly morphed into a live group with Johnny, our drummer, who's in Valencia. And then we started recording songs and we're encouraged to do an album. And then we've just put out Pushing Up, which is our sort of first proper song. Kind of hints of what the album's like. It's definitely not the most immediate or radio-friendly song, but it's definitely a great soundbite of what the record's going to be like. So yeah, it's had a good response so far. So that makes us motivated to put some more out as opposed to sort of hang up our guitars.
And yeah, pushing up was one of the tracks that we played live a bit as well, which was a really good experience. Obviously, we haven't done that for a while, but yeah, we were playing a few venues around East London and went down to Brighton, Portsmouth, and that was a really good opportunity to sort of test the track out as well, test the other tracks and sort of see what was working. And yeah, evolved into a bit of a monster.
Is it tricky putting that sort of thing together, given the restrictions we've been under over the last 16 months, 18 months?
Yes and no. I mean, it's a good job that Kieran and me don't like being in the same room, and the fact that technology's advanced so much that we can exchange files and sort of share ideas that way. But yes, it's definitely missed being in a live room and playing the songs. I guess when you're not in a live room and you're writing songs and you're sort of relying on a computer as part of the creative process, you go down slightly different avenues that obviously mean it's harder to replicate live, and you have to interpret it a bit differently. But yeah, I mean, restrictions are easing, which, you know, I'm not going to go down the road of saying whether I think it's right or wrong. So I guess live music's on its way back, which is awesome, as long as we don't all kill each other. And yeah, it'll be good when it's safe to play some shows and play to live audiences again.
Awesome. So the tune's up on Spotify and Apple Music and the like. Where's the best place for listeners to seek you out on social media and stuff?
So yeah, we're on Instagram, we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter. I mean, I think if you're of Kieran and my generation, I think you have a preference as opposed to going on all of those and TikTok as well. I mean, I love Twitter. Kieran had a bad experience with Twitter, so I know he's not really in love with the platform. I don't know, Kieran, what you're an Instagram kind of guy.
It's just tough, isn't it? Because, you know, we're obviously a different generation. Oh, it's not about generations. It's just about inclination, I suppose. And I don't want to get too bogged down into the details, but I was building up my social media presence, let's say, about maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And then my Twitter account got hacked. And that just dealt me a bit of a confidence. It dented my confidence. I've never really bounced back. So I've got a... This is just the slight new world that we're living in, but Ben and I are trying to adjust to rapidly. But yeah, we're on social media. We've got presence. Just don't type in type two error band, because if you just type in type two error, you get inundated with like the statistical and theoretical background of what a type two error is, which I'm not going to explain. I'm going to hand that over to Ben because he he chose the name. But yeah. Definitely check us out on Apple Music, Spotify, and a whole bunch of other streaming platforms.
Awesome, guys. So be following how things progress as we come out of lockdown. Very good. So what about if we jump back a bit then? How does the process of setting up Type 2 Error compare to way back when and starting out in the Cooper Temple Claws?
I guess there's similar parallels about how the sound has evolved and started organically with no huge aspirations in terms of just playing music collectively for the enjoyment of it, and then from there taking it into more of a structured song format. Obviously, in the Cooper Temple Claws, when we started, there were six of us. So there was a big wall of sound on a pig farm just outside Reading. And that was an incredible place to express ourselves as we were growing up, and it was just, you know, to take in all our influences and meld them together and play off each other and write and sing about how we were feeling growing up in a satellite town and the experiences that we were having. And, you know, what was amazing was that it quickly seemed to resonate with a lot of people about what we were sharing and singing about. And with the Cooper Temple Claws, is we were definitely a live band, a touring band. I think that was one of the few things we were set on when we first started, that we just wanted to go on the road and play live to people. We didn't want to rely on sort of other people talking about us, or, you know, we wanted people to come and see us and listen to the music themselves. And so, yes, the Cooper Temple Clause was definitely started similar to Type 2 Aero. We were just in the room, but it morphed into a very much a live band, whereas Type 2 Aero, because of the pandemic and also other things going on in my life, I'd say more of a studio band, so very different.
Yeah, you do look back in the sort of the early noughties when we were doing first Cooper's record, the second, and all of them. We just had, like, time was just such a extensive resource back then. And, you know, you forget, I think, how privileged we were. We just sort of took it for granted in some ways, I think. So you've got that. You've got a different way of understanding time, I think, when you're that age as well. You're very much locked in a small world. I'd say Ben and I are still locked in a small world, but as Ben alludes to, we've sort of got other parts of our lives going on, which sort of is in tension with, I suppose, doing some of the music. But I think it also enriches it. It gives you a different perspective of what the music's about and the pace you want to do it at, and actually just, it's totally your own project because you're doing it for the love. You're not doing it for any major label anymore, which has been, I think, yeah, definitely liberating, I'd say.
Yes, sort of influences and bands that inspire you change over that time as well. But if you go back to forming Cooper Temple Clause, what were the sort of the bands that you were loving at that point? Were there anyone you were trying to replicate either in the studio or on those live stages?
I think... you know, music is so important at any age, but especially in your formative years, growing up. And I think Tom and me started playing together when, I should caveat that, started playing instruments together when we were around 12, 13. And then Fish and Kieran from about the age of 15. So there was a lot of guitar bands around then. Electronic bands as well, Prodigy, big. I remember Radiohead were big, Blur were big. You had the classics like Floyd, Kraftwerk, Bowie, Pistols. I'd say countless others. Deus were huge influence on the band, the Beta Band also, Beck. You know, there was so much stuff that we were just, that was inspiring us. And I guess you can probably hear some bands influence more than others in our music, but yeah, I mean, a very rich tapestry. And the great thing about being in the band with your best friends at that time is everyone's always bringing you new record. Have you heard, you know, this band? Yeah. Have you heard of this band? You know, and then just listening to it and really enjoying it as fans, first and foremost. So yeah, there's a huge wealth of sort of shared music when we were that age. And then as the band started progressing, I think everyone started to find more of their nuanced appreciation of different styles and genres of music. You know, we had people who were really into post-rock music, people who are still really heavy into heavy rock, people a lot more into electronic, people becoming a bit more into jazz music. And so we sort of started to veer in different directions. But at the start, at the base when we were, when we first started forming, there was definitely a lot of shared influences resonating through and permeating throughout everything that we did.
Yeah, as Ben says, I think something I miss today is that simple joy of going to the record shop. Oh, God, I sound old.
they can say that out, Kieran.
Yeah. And it's not that record shops, obviously, they still exist, but they don't exist in the same way. And well, we were just really lucky to, yeah, I think have a bit of money in our pockets and go out and share interests and share crossovers. And as yeah, Ben's saying, like, you would get different groupings and sort of collaborations going within the six of us, which is a really rich part of it. And you get different jams, different ideas, and you'd see what happens when like post rock rubs up against Warp Records and Boards of Canada. And yeah, I think that Montreal Constellation Records scene was a massive inspiration for us. We loved that sort of DIY aesthetic and that DIY approach that you could create your own world and create your own, yeah, create your own merchandise and, you know, leave little gifts inside EPs and all that sort of tactility and that materiality, I guess that's changed a bit. We're going to have to think about how to bring that back a bit, I think, with Type 2 era, but obviously massive pluses to have everything digital and streaming these days.
Well, your lectures are finished now, haven't they? You've got the summer, so you can start to do sort of handcrafted vinyls and little notes until you start serve again.
Well, I actually live by a railway, so I could do what Godspeed You Black Emperor did, and one of theirs like was to put like coins on the railway and they'd get flattened by the train. And they did that like 200 times for a limited edition. I've got one of those. So I could risk my life for us, Ben, if you really want me to go down that route.
Well, I think we both know the answer is yes. And I think we both know the answer is that you wouldn't even do that. So
time to get busy. Because that record shop experience is certainly very different these days compared to what it was back in those early 2000s, which is when your debut album hit the shelves, 2002, See This Through and Leave came out. For us, that's kind of what we see as you talked about some of your influences a moment ago and the band you listened to sort of in the build up to that debut album. But those early 2000s were really sort of the start of what we see as this booming guitar bands that Pete and I and many others got into. What are your memories of that time of touring with lots of similar bands or other guitar bands? Was it did it feel like a scene to you? Did you feel like it was building a buzz? Did you feel part of it? What are your memories of that sort of early 2000s time when you released that debut album?
Well, I'll buy Kieran some time and start off by answering. So hopefully you can give it a really well-rounded answer.
Yeah, I'll pick up what you don't cover.
So unsurprisingly, my memory's pretty hazy throughout the band. So what I do remember is the bands that we played with the most, and we did so many shows with Biffy Clyro and Muse. I think they were the two bands that we toured with the most around that time. Probably played most shows with Biffy, so going throughout the UK in numerous tours, going up in Europe, then to Europe, Germany, Norway, doing many shows with them, and they were, you know, so phenomenal to see their success and how they've grown album after album. And I guess one of our biggest sort of support tours, well, first support tours that we did was with Muse, and that was great. They were really welcoming and really enjoyed seeing them. I think in terms of other bands of that time, we weren't necessarily close to any of them or felt any particular affinity with them. Maybe it's because we're quite introverted as a band, and also we had that union within us with the six of us, so we have that sort of gang where, you know, you're with your best friends, so you want to spend lots of time with your best friends. I think a lot of those bands at the time were influenced by hardcore bands. A lot of them were influenced by sort of Britpop and Radiohead as well. And so it was great to be able to play lots of shows and have lots of venues to play, which there aren't so many now. So really fond memories, especially of just going to sort of random towns and playing, rocking up at a pub and playing. A memory I have is playing in Doncaster, and I think there are probably about less than 10 people there, and that I just caned it too hard and I couldn't sing. So on the day we just had to decide Dids was going to sing and I was going to play bass. And that was fun for us. But in terms of other bands around that time, back to your question, scene, I think Biffy and Muse would be the two because we played so much with them and, you know, big fans of them and what they've gone on to do.
That was a really good answer. I don't think I could add much.
Sorry, I thought you were writing notes there, Kieran.
Yes,
I thought you were
just going to...
I was going.
Big grandiose answer.
I don't have much memorabilia, but I do actually have like a bunch of like lanyards and stuff. You can't see it with the wallpaper effect, but it's just weird. Like what Ben was saying, yeah. Like you'd get that. Obviously, the bands that you had a closest affinity with would be the ones you're touring with day in day out. But then, apparently we played with Element of Grime, Gomez. Star Sailor, the music, Stephen Malkmus, 100 Reasons, Sean Paul, Jane's Addiction. That was a one live in Brighton. So like a lot of those interactions were pretty
good. Goodness, you're not going to go through them all.
Yeah, I mean, I could. How long have we got? So yeah, it was definitely on when they're supporting us, I think, the bands that Ben's mentioned already, Oceanside as well. That was really fun when you could sort of build up a bit, yeah, a bit of a relationship with them. But then I think that was, thinking about this, like we were also, as Ben's already said, slight outcasts, like with the way we were very much in our own world doing the music. And I think that was what made it work, that being, having that farm, that studio in the farm just outside Wokingham, having our own world. And there wasn't really much of a scene in Reading. There was a bit, but again, that was, we were outside of Reading. So I think, yeah, we sort of had our own culture a bit.
If we talk about the songs on that debut album, which sort of propelled you into the onto these stages with those sort of bands, Who Needs Enemies is the one that jumps out for me, because it was one that I had listened to loads and loads at the time. And I remember it being all over MTV2, for instance. So can you just tell us a little bit about how that one in particular came together? Because that seemed like a real important tune for you guys at the time.
I can remember a small anecdote, which actually is, I think, was a really key part of the track. Because I think I'd been away when Ben, Tom and Fisher, I guess, had jammed it or written most of it. But the brass weren't in. And I think it was when I was we'd been working on it and I had to go. I left early, like I always do, stupidly. And then the next morning, like really early in the morning, I just got a voice message from Ben, like playing me back the horns and like the trumpets that they put down. And I couldn't believe it. It was just like the band had moved into this next phase. And I guess this is before before we were signed or maybe shortly after? But that richness was, amazing, the sort of brass section. And then seeing all those different components come together. So that was very much Tom and Ben's trumpet days really paying off the big bucks.
Yeah, I mean, actually, you stirred a negative memory from me was actually when we're working out the brass parts. I worked out a beautiful trombone part. But that, you know, the power of the band, they shut that down, said the trumpets being laid was enough. And it was a really good trombone part. We never got to hear an actual trombone player play it. We didn't actually know any trombone players. That song came organically in terms of just jamming and playing live in a room, you know, and just, you know, hearing someone. I think it would have started with the chords on the piano or the bass line from Tom, and then Fish started to sort of play a Gilmore lick, and it sounded great because it sounded like it was a DIY Gilmore. And then we just took it from there. And then I think it was before we were signed. I think that was one of the first songs that we wrote where we thought, okay, well, we should, you know, keep persevering with this and spend more time trying to craft this, because this is, you know, this feels really good playing this song.
I think it was called the Porter's Head one for a while. And it was definitely, was it Tom's 8-track? I can't remember what it was called, the tape.
The Reel to Reel. We'd have the Reel to Reel. Because then did start playing with the Reel to Reel and then started to use the sample. And I think, yeah, because we've got the sample at the end that we paid a fortune for. I mean, we could have decided not to have the sample like Isaac Hayes, but we decided that we were going to use it instead of replicate it. We were going to use it and pay him a fortune from it. So advised badly.
Yeah,
but I guess we're honest, as opposed to sort of replicating it and then trying to, you know, not get around him receiving any royalties or license fees from us.
Yeah, absolutely. Huge tune, and the album itself as a whole did terrifically well when that first came out. You know, really good positive reaction from critics. What are your memories of sort of promoting it, and where did you find good support, like from, you know, radio DJs, magazines, TV appearances? Any of those sort of particularly stick in your memories of being important bits of support?
I won't be able to remember everything, but certainly the press were really, pockets of press were really good to us. I think the NME really gave us a massive head start. We did, yeah, they, was there a cover for the first album or was that the second album? And yeah, the sort of small underground press and like doing the venues. Oh, I can't remember the names. It's really bad. I should have thought before I started talking, but I think that was a big advantage. Yeah. Having that sort of the journalist game behind us.
There was a step before that, because we were adamant that we wanted to go out and do and play live and build a following that way organically, as opposed to try to be shoved down journalist throats by our PR company, PR agent. It was also, there was a catalyst for the, I guess, support was when I think the NME ran an article about asking its readers to write in about bands it liked or bands that they wanted to be written about. And I think it was, we were overwhelmingly the top band. And I think it was then they started to take notice of us, because we were very much following, I guess, quite an obstinate route in terms of, we just wanted to play live and play to people. We didn't really want to play the game that the music industry was, but we're also young that we didn't quite know what the game entailed and how much you need the industry to have a career in the music industry. So it's all very green around the ears, and it was people writing in about us organically, which suddenly got the NME to write about us. And then I think there's a few bands that mentioned to Kerrang about us, so they started to cover us, and then MTV too. So we had quite a lot of support there with the videos. That was a great forum for us to get into people's living rooms on TV screens. So in the UK, definitely that. And then in Germany and Japan, they took to us very early. So we had amazing sort of coverage in Germany and in Japan. I think we went to go and play there before, I think right after the Hardware EP. So that was really early on. And remember when we got off the plane, like people there waiting for us, and we had to look around, just couldn't quite believe it. If you think we would have been, must have been around 19 or something like that. It was just very surreal. And I remember when we were recording the first record, I can't remember what it's called. That was a big Japanese music magazine. They came to do like a double page, I think it was like a few pages, but a double page photo spread on us. And it was that time we're doing in Studio World. So we'd all grown handlebars. And obviously, being in our late teens, early 20s, some of us, two of whom are on this call, were able to grow very impressive handlebar moustaches. Some who still had a lot of bum fluff just looked bad. And so then there's this big photo of us in a Japanese magazine going, looking like I don't know what, but it was just like this. It just felt right at the time. And I'm sure somewhere one of us has got a picture of that. And I might try and find it and then post it on our Instagram or something, because it was just such a funny photo shoot. Do you remember that, Kieran?
Yeah, I do, vividly, outside Great Linford. But yeah, it didn't faze us. That was a good thing. You don't know anything different. And yeah, very, very lucky to get that international exposure. So that becomes something to talk about, and I think gives you momentum for when you come back over to the UK as well. But yeah, the touring definitely helped. Endless touring and building up that fan base and that rapport with people who know about your music and go out to buy it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we definitely need to see that photo. Yeah, definitely get that out of the cupboard and up onto social media. And as you say, yeah, fantastic that this growth just begins with working hard on the live scene and building that foundation, that fan base. And that's where it takes you from there. And obviously the momentum just kept going for the second album, and we'll pick up there in part two.
Hi there, this is Ben and Kieran from the Cooper Temple Claws, and you're listening to Boys in the Band podcast.
I'm Chief Conti of the Metropolitan Police Department. Distracted driving is putting lives at risk. Help us make Vision Zero a reality by keeping your eyes on the street. MPD is enforcing DC's hands-free distracted driving laws. One text or call can wreck it all.
You're listening to the Boys in the Band podcast. For more noughties nostalgia, check out our Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram pages, and make sure you hit subscribe to the podcast for more interviews like this.
Welcome back to the Boys in the Band podcast, where we're with Ben and Kieran from the Cooper Temple Claws. Now, we've discussed the debut in part one, but just 19 months later, guys, album two comes out, Kick Up the Fire and Let the Flames Break Loose. As we went to number five, so really successful, but very quick turnaround. So how do you manage that? You know, you spoke about how young you were when that first album was coming out, when you were rising quickly to playing these bigger and bigger shows, getting attention from various magazines and MTV2, etc. How do you find that second process of the second album?
From what I recall, it was pretty much straight off the tour bus and into the studio. I think there's a few ideas kicking around, and we'd used the budget for recording album two to kit out a home, sort of a home studio on the barn. So we upgraded from one unit to two units. It was a big move in the Shires. Yeah, it was quite a dark time. I know there was a couple of heavy breakups within the band in terms of relationships, and you know, I guess touring does have its dark side, and you know, it's quite a dark record, and I think it's definitely shaped by towards the end of touring that first record and how hard we toured it. And went straight into very long hours in the studio, really late finishes, relatively early starts. It was just quite full on and intense in terms of how much blood, sweat, and tears went into that record. And on that record, we didn't have like 20 songs to pick from. We only had a few, and I was speaking to someone the other day, he was asking me about, asked us why a song called On Off On wasn't on the record. And I just sort of said, you know, it's of the same time, but when we started to get through the sequencing, that was the one that didn't quite make it. We didn't feel it didn't sit right with the sort of sequencing and the vibe of the other songs. And there was no break. It was just full on straight into the studio. And yeah, from my memories, we didn't see much daylight. And I remember, one memory that springs to mind is when we ordered a takeaway from the local Indian takeaway, and the man came around with all this music equipment, this mixing desk, guitars, basses, keyboards. He says, "Oh, what are you guys doing here then?" And no one had the heart to tell him to look around. So just a bit silent. But that was also the time, for some reason, I guess, to keep our spirits up. And we sort of had fancy dress Thursday, didn't we, for a very long time. It started to get more and more serious. So that was quite strange. I don't really know how that happened, but that was sort of another memory from that time.
Yeah, I guess looking back at it, it was a really quick turnaround for that second album. Just as Ben said, really, you've got that momentum coming off tour, like completing the first one and just really eager to get in, stuck into the next one. And I think a lot of the tracks we were sort of playing live and jamming, and it just had a natural pace to it, I think, that the first one had as well, but I guess it was recorded in a slightly different way, in different places, but we just had this really focused ability to just use the Bleak House, as it was then called, our studio outside Wokingham, and to really drill down. And we had an amazing engineer producer as well, Dan Austin, who helped us fix the sounds like really immediately down, I think, so we could use a lot of the sounds we were experimenting with, and we'd do I suppose it would also be shift work, wouldn't it be, I suppose, Ben, like you'd have like these different rooms where people are working on vocals or B-sides, doing more of the sort of structural editing in the main room, perhaps vocals. So yeah, a bit of a nice little music factory.
Yeah, and it was a difficult album as well, sorry, because and Dids was hospitalised for a large chunk of it as well, very severe appendicitis. So that was difficult as well, sort of making a record, doing long hours, not seeing any daylight, and then, you know, your best friend in hospital. So, yeah, it was you know, when you live in the moment, you'll do it, everything seems normal. It's only when you sort of reflect back and sort of see how strange it was that we went straight into write the record. We were doing sort of 18 to 20 hour days. You know, it's not like we were had to clock in and clock out. We're just full on. Someone's hospitalized quite seriously. Every Thursday we're dressing up as someone. You know, I remember it was just looking back and trying to piece back some of the memories now. It's just a very insane time there.
Tell us more about this fancy dress Thursdays. Come on, what characters were we seeing in the studio?
Well, I think, so again, this is obviously you're asking me, so it's going to be a biased memory. But it started off, and I don't know who had the concept. But when I turned up on that first Thursday, I think I was dressed as like a movie director. And everyone else was dressed as a sports character or sports hero or heroine. And like everyone got angry at me saying, why have you come as, you know, a French, you know, a movie director, like when everyone else is, you know, following the theme? And it's because no one actually fucking told me that I had to, that there was a theme. And it was, you know, it was then that we made sure that everyone knew what the theme would be. But as the weeks progressed, very much Fish and Tom were constantly battling to be, you know, the best, wearing best fancy dress. So we get to the point on the Thursdays where it'd be past like 3 PM and both of them hadn't turned up because they're spending so much time creating their own outfit. It wasn't the case of, you know, going out to buy an outfit. It was a case of actually making stuff at home. And so, you know, one that springs to mind is when they did Battle. I think Tom came as an amazing sheep and everyone's just like, oh my God, Tom's going to win this week. And then about half an hour, Fish rocks up as this elephant and he's done some crazy stuff with coat hangers. He's raided his families. He's gone to see his sister, his brother, all these much grey clothing and just looks like the most realistic human elephant you ever see. And so Tom's devastated, he's lost that week. So it sort of, it probably didn't do good for the band's sort of collective morale because that sense of competition between them was just, it just got very fierce. So there's a different theme every week. I think one week we were dressed as Britpop? Kim, what was it? 80s music? 80s? No, it's 80s.
Yeah, he had 80s. We had Spice Girls one. Maybe we don't talk about that one.
The 80s music one, though. Remember the 80s music one? And then we had to film a video for Rick Rubin, who was, you know, wanted to know if he could get involved in the record. And so there's a video of us dressed in very random 80s gear.
He asks for a video message, doesn't he, from prospective bands?
Yeah, I don't know why. It's very strange. Like, we're in the middle of making a record. We're in the middle of a very serious competitive fancy dress competition. We have to leave a message for Rick Rubin. Yeah. But anyway, we didn't hear back from Rick. Yeah, we didn't hear back from Rick. But no, I guess that was just a bit of try to keep our sort of spirits up and not, you know, always remember not to try to take ourselves too seriously.
Yeah, well, it certainly worked because obviously the album went on to do, you know, really, really well. Another couple of massive breakthrough tracks for the band, I felt at the time. Promises and Blind Pilots really seemed to propel you even further than that first record did. Your memories of those two songs sort of landing pretty well?
I guess, you know, it was building on the momentum and base we'd had from that first record. I think Kick Up the Fire and the Flames Break Loose works really well as a record from start to finish. I think it didn't necessarily have many songs that you could consider for radio. I think they were the two probably standout songs. You know, we did toy with the idea of new toys, but because it's got that very important outro that's quite musical that isn't conventional, sort of didn't think we were advised that that wouldn't, and rightly so, that wouldn't necessarily work on lots of radio. So yeah, fond memories of those. You know, I think we had the kid from Biker Grove, didn't we, Kieran, in the Promises video, and then we launched Fassbender's career. So I guess, you know, it was just doing our bit. yeah, they're definitely two songs that, two of our favourite songs playing live as well.
Yeah, the videos are very memorable doing. Again, another business decision that is questionable, just the amount of outlay that would have been put into that. Like huge productions, really fun at the time, but you don't sort of get told that actually that is just going against your name and you have got to recoup that at the end of the day. But it, I think it helped. Yeah. I mean, you can't, yeah. Also, yeah, definitely helped get
us
MTV play.
I think about that. We weren't really ever thinking about, you know, let's become, you know, let's make as much money as we can, because we always said that about why we, you know, we wanted the songs to find their own form as opposed to trying to be a bit more conventional. But yeah, you're right. You know, I guess the outlay for all the stuff, turning Fassbender into Pan, would have cost an arm and a leg, but it's a great video, isn't it?
So, it is a good video. It's one that I watch back from time to time. And indeed that record, yeah, is just, it is, I think, one of my personal favorites out of the three. Because it takes you, yeah, to like very cohesive, like particular time in our lives. Somehow, real good atmosphere, I think.
So obviously, you talk about sort of the quick turnaround for that album. It was 4 years for the third album, so obviously a lot happened in that period as well. Dids went off to Dirty Pretty Things, split from RCA, the record company, as well. So just tell us about that. So it appears after sort of quite a rapid, fast upward trajectory, there's a bit of turbulence at that point. Is that fair or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think just to look back at it, part of the reason that I went into do psychology after the band was just that the lack of cohesive guidance that we had as a collective, in terms of, you know, Kieran discussed it earlier about getting perspective, getting, having more strings to your bow, more, is that we were just living and breathing the band. And so we didn't really have individual identities, and we were absolutely exhausted going to do that second record, but we sort of did it, that energy, naive exuberance, sort of the experience of the road, the relationships really fueled that second record. But then we went and toured that extensively, and we went straight back into the record as opposed to having a long break. And really, I think that's where we needed some senior steward or some guidance, just to say, look, have a break, guys. You've been at it for, you know, 8 years or 7 years nonstop. And so we didn't. We went back in and just had lots of, you know, ideas. Then our A&R man left, and that was, and he was, you know, a big part of our success. He was someone who was very experienced. He signed us, recognized immediately that we were a band that needed to be left to their own devices to get the maximum from the collective. He left, someone else came in, who I think was Paul Young's drummer. He was just Mr. Corporate, and it's just like, this is a bad fit. This is an arranged marriage. So instantly he didn't get what we're about. We also then had someone else get involved who was being A&R in Tears for Fears, obviously amazing band. He'd been doing Julian Cope, quite a lot of acts, and didn't get us either, and wanted to sort of try and change the dynamics of how the band worked. And then we went out, so we did lots of ideas with Dan. Then this A&R man took us to go and work with his producer, who clicked with some but not others. And then we had a lot of tired ideas, and that, instead of sort of scrapping them and starting again and trying to do something a bit more DIY and a bit more of the moment, spontaneous, we were drawing out these songs for a long, long period. And then we were sort of away from our natural habitat, which was the studio, the Bleak House that Kieran mentioned. So started to get strained, and then Dids had family commitments in London, and we were just outside Bath recording this. It just started to get a bit frayed, and then plus the fact that we were all absolutely emotionally exhausted, and as young men, you know, weren't comfortable speaking about how we were feeling or even aware of that's how we were feeling. And so it just became a very sort of strained record. And whilst we did want to make a record that was different from the first two and more poppy, it was very much a record where we should have scrapped it, even if we had some great songs to start again and just do a bit more something at the moment. But hindsight's a wonderful thing. We put out a record that's got some really good songs on it. But as we were just talking about Kick Up The Fire sort of being a very cohesive record, it's definitely quite a disjointed record in terms of the songs and how they sort of fit together, because they were written, like you said, over a longer time span.
Yeah, it was... I think it does. It was an unfortunate contrast compared to the second record. I think I'm sure we've all learned a lot of lessons about that process in terms of sort of the creative energy that we had as a collective in the first and second one. And then when you have executives or creative directors who aren't musicians necessarily, try to come in and shape your sound and your process, your creative process, with the ambition of wanting to make something more commercially driven that we were never really about, never wanted to be about. We wanted just to create our own music the way we wanted to do it to our fan base. And I think that was, yeah, as Ben says, when you're young, you don't always have the confidence. Like, big record labels wield a huge amount of power over, and still do, over young people's, I think, sort of creative careers. And I'm not saying that we were, horrifically abused or anything, but it does, I think it, looking back, you feel like we could have taken a bit more control. If we had taken a bit more control, I think we would have gone to a different place. But again, that's in hindsight.
Yeah, I think, talk about valuable lessons. I think one for me was just about being more open about how you're feeling. I think my natural inclination as an individual is always just to be stubborn and plow on, and actually just say, look, I'm not okay. I'm feeling quite low, feeling quite depressed. I feel tired. The relationships that the band had been based on, in terms of that strong friendship, definitely dissipating, and that's the reason why we broke up. And it was incredible strength of character and courage for Fish to be the one to sort of say that he wasn't feeling and hadn't been feeling for a while okay. And thankfully the friendships for most of us have stayed strong. When I got married, Tom and Kieran were best men, Fish master of ceremony. Their friendships, which the band were there before the band, they've been able to outlive the band, which was more important to us than trying to carry on and shedding band members and carrying on, where you end up with no original members of the Cooper Temple Clause, but names still going on. And valuable life lessons and, you're richer because of them.
So how, obviously, say that Fish was the one who kind of orchestrated the move towards the end of the band. Was that... Is that an easy decision to kind of agree to, given sort of the path you've been on for that third album? Was it hard to step away?
No, surprisingly easy. I remember where we were. We were just at the pub that's closest to us, the Bleak House studio. Fish sort of, I think we had a tour of shows coming up, and sort of Fish just, we were having some food, and Fish sort of just, dropped how he was feeling, and then pretty much like domino, everyone said, yeah, pretty much the same. And it wasn't kind of like a long, strung out argument. It was like, a sense of relief for many of us. Yeah, acceptance, a sense of relief, actually. And
especially off the courage. Back of some, yeah, it was really brave of, I think, Fish to step up and talk so honestly, which, helped us sort of find out where we were. And we, that was coming off also the back of some really heavy tours to Japan and probably a couple around the UK as well. So, and you go back to then, so I think some of us were living with our parents still. We were sort of weird, like this financial limbo that you're, in some ways, your career's doing quite well, you're playing to big audiences, but then you don't have like the longer term financial stability, which was just a really uncomfortable
place. Which you see from bands more so now, sort of bands who've got millions of streams, having to lose money when they just play a few shows and not making any revenue from sales, it's gone one way. So, I feel for a lot of artists now where, that's, what they do. I know I've got a few friends who are still touring, but they have to have second and third jobs to sort of juggle everything. I think it was, it was interesting as well that, I think we fulfilled as many obligations as we could before, Fish spoke up, but it was quite interesting then sort of the trajectories that everyone went into. Kieran had been doing his first year of Fire Open University of his degree. Fish went into sort of vocation straight away. I think he wanted to write a book and he started writing and collecting ideas for his book. I think John just escaped to Bristol, and I think he's had a successful career sort of lecturing in music. And then, I think Tom then knew that he wanted to carry on doing music, so he went straight back to the Bleak House and started writing, and it wasn't long after that Losers started to happen, and we started to have ideas with that. And I think I was in a bit of head scratching, and I knew I didn't want to write, I didn't want to do any music, maybe ever, or for a period I wanted to sort of discover another side of myself and follow other interests. And just by hook and by crook, managed to get in clearing to Goldsmiths. And I'm partly intrigued by my own experience about what happened within the band and how we started as sort of this band of brothers collective, and how sort of communication became so limited, and we became so almost ready to throttle each other, how that could happen. And I was absolutely intrigued by that psychology. So I went to do psychology and thought maybe my own past could maybe be involved in music or work with bands and get them to sort of try to open up and discuss what's happening, or maybe even sports psychology, because I'm mad about sport. And then suddenly thought, hang on, let's take a backward step. I don't want to sort of mix a work and a passion again, because I've done that already. And it was great. It was a great roller coaster, but it can also drain you. So it was, I guess, we reached a natural conclusion, and thankfully the friendships have stayed strong, we sort of, whilst for a long period we didn't see Did, we sort of, got back in contact, or we've all got more contact. We now got a thread on WhatsApp. We now need to do some video messages for his 40th on Monday. So we've got to make sure we record some messages with each of us. It'd be nice to do that for a surprise. So as long as this doesn't go out before Monday, it won't be a surprise. It was the right time to call it a day. And I think it may have been different if we'd had some time away from the band and from each other between the end of fulfilling touring commitments in album two and album three. But, you learn from mistakes, you learn from your experiences, and it's the scars that make us who we are.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the way it went. And as you say, just learn from that, don't you? I just think it's fascinating, the sort of different careers you mentioned there that people have gone into. And Ben, obviously you're Managing Director of Great Place to Work, so a consultancy about work environments, as you were suggesting there, how people get on and work together. Working from home, we're obviously doing this over Zoom. What are your thoughts about that, and returning to the office? Your professional opinion?
Yeah, strange. It's strange.
It cost you.
It was in my I went on to do a master's straight after my undergrad, and I thought I was going to get into sports psychology. So how golfers can get the yips, or even how musicians you can be a concert pianist and play amazingly at home, but when you're with an audience, how you're sort of, for some reason, that external environment can influence your performance. So I thought I was going to get into something like
England
that.
Footballers taking penalties, for instance.
Yes, very much so. But I think it's got its own dogma about that now, that the nation keeps talking about how we're bad at penalties, and so it's just ingrained in everyone. But and then I got really intrigued by this notion about how, and it identified immediately with the band, about how important communication is with those who you work with, irrespective of if you're in a white collar job, a blue collar job, you're a musician, you work in a supermarket. Those people that you work with, and those, and if there's a leader, a manager that you report to, the impact they have in your enjoyment, be able to be as productive and to be your authentic self, whatever your vocation, we are people. So that plays a huge impact. And I found that fascinating, the concept of, you know, how we can be influenced in terms of our motivation and pride. And I thought, actually, you know, I can, that resonated a lot with that in the band, about how communication became very frayed internally, but then also with the record label, PR, externally, our manager. And it was just, you know, I found it could instantly connect the dots with my own experiences with what the academic literature was saying. So sort of earned to this career. And it's amazing to work with lots of organizations and touch lots of sort of people's working lives by trying to help improve their experience at work. We spend more time at work than with our families or friends, unfortunately. But this whole notion about where we are at the moment, you know, for a lot of organizations, people have been able to do their job away from home. They've actually been spending more time working as opposed to commuting. It's got to an unhealthy point where they're spending more time working than they should do, because it's impossible to get that detachment between work and home life. But it's amazing to see a lot of leaders suddenly want to tell everyone they've got to come back to the office, even though the organization's been more successful. Just, you know, it seems absolutely mad. So, you know, I'm a big advocate of, if your technology enables you to be able to work from home. And I think what most people want is to have that choice, have some kind of hybrid, flexible option. And ultimately, that's what people want, to be treated like adults as opposed to animals or what have you. So we'll see what happens.
Indeed, yeah. No, really interesting insight. Thanks for that, Ben. And thanks to both of you for joining us today to talk about the Cooper Temple Clause story and Type 2 Error 2, of course. But we're going to wrap things up with the encore, guys. Now, obviously, doing our research on the band, you know, we discovered that the Cooper Temple Clause was a legislative clause.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah. Oh, mate. Try and say that with your false teeth in.
You know, one of them government things in the Education Act back in the day that made primary education compulsory. So our first question in the encore is, what was your favourite subject at school?
Oh, great question. Kieran, I'll let you answer this one first.
I wasn't very good at school. I did really enjoy music. I didn't get a very good grade, but I think GCSE music was so much fun. You could just sort of mess around with xylophones and keyboards and then doing AS music. That was quite fun, sort of the joint performance of that. So I'll say music and half part and history, probably up there.
Okay. I'd probably say for me, history. I think modern history as well. And I think I remember a vivid memories around propaganda suddenly used during World War II and sort of brainwashing and how important propaganda was in terms of brainwashing people in Germany, but also how important it was with the US and the Allies as well. And I distinctly remember thinking, wow, you know, thank goodness we sort of live in a sort of freer world now. And then, you know, what has been happening over, you know, year on year, I'd say over the last, especially 10 to 15 years, but it's always been in the background with cronyism, you know, how the message is conveyed by certain tabloids and the influence of Murdoch, and, you know, just seeing what's happening in the, you know, speaking from the UK perspective, as I know that, you know, live here, it's just unbelievable that it seems, you know, it's no better, the control and lies that we're fed. So, you know, for me, yeah, not to go down too much of a tangent or just rant, and yeah, history. I really enjoyed history.
Well, just getting back to the band for the final two questions. What was the best gig you guys ever did together?
As Coopers or Type 2 Error?
As Coopers. You can have, if there's a particularly good Type 2 Error one already, you can shout out to that one.
it's tough to beat, I think, some of the Cooper's gigs. I think playing, it was more of a general experience. It wasn't a particular gig, I'd say, but touring with The Cure, doing the Curiosa tour. We didn't talk about that, but that was just as a total experience, just phenomenal. Waking up, like doing a show at midday in the car park, maybe 20 people watching you, and then just having a free festival for the rest of the day with catering and trying to steal golf carts, watching Interpol, Mogwai, Muse, and then obviously Cure in the evenings every day. Like, it was just, yeah. So I know that's not really answering the question, but I'll take that. I'm going to hold on to that memory for a long time.
Yeah, it's also where things soured with Muse, wasn't it? Because Fish tackled Chris, and Chris broke his arm, and they had to go home from the tour, and they had to get a replacement musician for when they were headlining the festival.
Okay, yeah.
But Fish maintained it was a legitimate tackle, and if it was a fair tackle, then, you know, it's, I guess it's Chris's fault for coming off worse. I think
if you're going to play competitive football on a very hard concrete surface,
under the influence,
yeah.
I think so. But yeah, it's funny that those football games started to morph into it. Ended up being about 20 a side, where there's bands playing. We had sort of I remember Alf de Mau was touring. They were all into it. Then we had fans, Cure fans joining in as well. So that was, yeah, that was good.
We had an intense football match in Howden Festival in Sweden, where we were pitched against a team of Brazilian acrobats. And we never were that fit, but we were trying. I just remember being on the wing and I had to like try and check this guy who was like running a million miles an hour. But I kept up with him. Anyway, what was your favorite one, Ben?
I think for the setting, Fuji Rock Festival. Played a couple of shows there. It's just, you know, if you get a chance to go to a festival, just the setting is amazing. And, you know, we also got to hang out with Joe Strummer there as well, which was amazing. Yeah. Such a lovely, genuine person. And then just, yeah, it's just incredible sort of show response from these people from another continent. Yeah, it's great to play those, I'd say, definitely. But yeah, Curiosa was really wonderful. But yeah, and there's a lot of great shows that will have their own little anecdotes and stories.
Awesome. And last up, guys, we like to ask our guests the song that they're proudest of. So can you pick a Cooper Temple Claws track out that you would say was your proudest?
Yeah, we just signed a new publishing deal, and the guy there's asked, you know, all of us to sort of pick some of our favourite songs from our repertoire. And yeah, it's very interesting that everyone picked very different songs. I think for me, a song that I really, really love playing live, love listening to it, is Music Box. There's something about it that just gets me every time, so I'd say that.
Cool. How about you, Kieran?
Choice. I think it's also going to be on that record. A go-to track is Same Mistakes for me. I think it's a great one that sort of sets the tone of the record. And it fulfilled our ambition of just doing one big crescendo, which is really fun to write and fun to play. So I miss that a lot.
Also sort of your narrative of your life as well, Kieran, isn't it?
I hope so. I mean, that's open to debate, but... So we'll pick up in another 20 years, right, guys, and we'll see.
Yeah,
we'll see if it's still get on the upward trend.
We'll see if the collagen and lip implants and everything Botox has worked.
Good stuff. Okay. We'll make a date in the diary for that one. Ben, Kieran, thanks for joining us. Thanks for talking us through the Cooper Temple Claws story, and best of luck with Type 2 Era and all the gigs that you've got lined up after lockdown, and once we can get out and play live shows again.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having us. Really nice to meet you.